Hello and welcome to the podcast. This is Ron's Amazing Stories, where we play tales to take you away from today. On the program today, we have a lesson in physics, an attack by a killer owl, a question from Wendy, and a tornado at Wendy's.
This just doesn't cut it.
Tough crowd. Okay then, how about I throw in Chapter 6 of Anything You Can Do, read by Mark Nelson.
You were going to do that anyway.
True. Okay, we also have another
Johnny, is this true?
Segment, and we continue with Tom's
Growing Up
series. Is that enough? I thought so. Here is our 5-minute mystery.
Another 5-minute mystery.
This 5-minute mystery is being brought to you by really bad lines that someone thinks are pretty cool. Like, dude, is that your face or did an owl attack you? That'll make more sense later on in the show. For now, let's get to today's story.
At the toll gate to the great new cross-country speedway, a sporty red convertible pauses.
How much, bud?
$1.50 to the next gate. Hey, what's the trouble with your friend there in the back seat all bandaged up that way?
Accident.
Oh, that's too bad. Well, good luck. Hey, take it easy. About 2 miles ahead. Repairs.
Okay, I'll watch it.
The convertible travels fast. 2 miles farther on, they round a slight curve. The temporary fences around the road repair work loom close ahead. There is a sudden shout from a man at the side of the highway.
Hey, look out!
Joe, did you see that? One of them guys fell out of the back seat. Let's get over there, quick.
So, Mr. Bryant, you say you weren't aware of the construction sign.
Not until I was right on top of him, Sheriff. Ask Al here. He was in the back seat with Johnny. Did we see him, Al?
Didn't the toll gate keeper warn you about that spot?
Well, the signs are moved for just a couple of minutes, Sheriff. Brad and I was out there to warn the cars to slow down.
Now, this guy came along so fast, though, we didn't get a chance.
You realize, of course, Mr. Bryant, that this is a very serious matter. The third person in your car, John Albertson, was killed instantly when he fell from the back seat. The toll gatekeeper reports that he was already the victim of an accident, was bound up in bandages.
I know, Sheriff. I shouldn't have driven so fast. I don't know what to say.
Well, let's hear your story, Joe.
Yeah, it was this way, Sheriff. Brad and I were standing alongside the highway, like I said, and all of a sudden this red convertible comes racing along, doing, at least 85 around the curve.
I see. Go on.
Well, the two guys in the back seat, this big man Al here and the other guy, they were sitting there with their heads down. When the brakes went on, they raised up. John, the bandaged one, fell out the back. He must have lost his grip, I guess. He just flew right out the back when the car stopped.
He flew out the back, eh?
Hey, Sheriff, can we go now? I'll come back later if you want, but I feel pretty bad about this. I think I could use some rest.
Rest? Sure, Mr. Bryant, you'll get plenty of rest. Right here in the county jail. I'm holding you for the murder of John Albertson.
What reason did the sheriff have for believing that John Albertson was murdered? In just a moment, we'll find out, but first...
Okay, let's review the facts. Car loses control, man falls out the back. He was already injured and bound with bandages. Wow. None of that really adds up because of the forward motion of the car. I guess the bandage man could have jumped, but that kind of seems unlikely. Let's go see about this.
And now, back to our five-minute mystery and the murder of John Albertson.
Murder? What are you talking about, Sheriff? There wasn't any murder.
It was murder, all right. And you and Al here collaborated on it. You see, Bryant, when a moving vehicle stops suddenly, the passengers in it are thrown forward, not backward. If Albertson lost his grip, he would have been thrown into the front seat, not back onto the highway. Your having him all bandaged up like that just made it easier for Al to throw him out. You see, Bryant, this time it was natural law that threw you into the hands of social law. Say, that's not a bad line.
No, Sheriff, that is a terrible line. You should have said, the laws of physics have thrown you into the laws of justice. Now that I can warm up to. Either way, it's just plain silly, so I leave you with this. This five-minute mystery was brought to you by really bad lines that someone thought weren't too bad. We have an email this week from Wendy Hogan. Wendy resides in Las Vegas, Nevada, and she writes this. Hey, Ron's Amazing Stories. I love the podcast and thought you might like to know how I found you. I live in Las Vegas, the original Sin City, but I'm originally from the Windy City in Chicago. How I got here is yet another story. One day, I was out with friends in the desert. It had just gotten dark, and we had lit a campfire, ready to enjoy some dessert in the desert. The topic was ghost stories. A friend said that the last time he was out here, he heard a radio show that was full of them. I said, hey, let's try to tune it in. We did, and guess whose voice came across the speakers? Yours. You were telling a very scary story about a cable man who had to deal with a ghost in an old basement. As you like to say, how about that? I've been a fan of your show ever since. Wendy Hogan from Sin City. Well, Wendy, how about that? That was an amazing coincidence, and I'm happy to have been there for you. We have been on the radio for several years now and have recently moved to Sunday nights at 8 p.m. in Las Vegas on KLAV AM 1520 or FM 99.5. How about that? I'm getting close to having enough stories for the military episode I have planned, but could use a few more. Please, if you have a story, share it with us. You can head to the main website, click on the story submission banner, and tell me all about it. Also, send us any story you might have. It can be funny, sad, cool like Wendy's, or freaky like the Cableman's story, which, by the way, I do remember. And now, these are your stories.
These are your stories, sent by you, for you.
Our listener story for this week comes from our old friend Ray Payton in Urania, Louisiana. Urania is a small town in the LaSalle Parish. Did you know that Louisiana is the only state to have parishes and not counties? Ray is a writer and has submitted other stories to the show. He was a guest on episode number 201 in 2015 and told us what it was like to be a contractor in Iraq. He also has shared his short story called Toy Soldiers. Today, Ray tells us a story from his series, Adventures of an Oil Man, and it is called An Owl Attack. In the mid-80s, I worked as a dispatcher for Frank's Casing Crew, which is an oil field service company in Alvin, Texas. We had 3 dispatchers on staff. We worked 12-hour shifts and rotated from days to nights to off. The story I'm about to tell you happened to me and is forever emblazoned into my memory. I was often alone there at night, and I didn't see a living soul until 6 a.m. when my relief arrived to take over. Sometimes, if business was slow, it would be so boring that at least once a shift, I would take my cordless phone and my .22 caliber Ruger pistol for a walk around the entire facility. You might call it a security check. In reality, I was just screwing off and taking a smoke break. Now, there was this 40-foot flagpole sitting outside the front office by the parking lot. Most nights you could walk outside, look up, and see an old white owl perched at the very top of that pole. On this particular night, I looked straight up that flagless pole, and sure enough, sat the owl, and she was looking down at me. We made eye contact, I swear. At 40 feet away, though, the owl didn't look all that big or even threatening. It was at that moment it happened. I must admit I briefly considered shooting that owl. I know it was an evil thought. Call it temptation. I wouldn't have done it. I knew better. You just don't kill a bird for the sake of killing. And especially not an endangered federally protected species like the owl. You could end up in the penitentiary. Also, no taxidermist would stuff it, so you can't hang it on your wall. Federal game wardens love to use rule breakers to set an example for others, and I knew that, too. It's kind of like coveting your neighbor's property and doing nothing. The Bible says you're still just as guilty. So anyway, at that very moment when I looked up at that owl, that evil thought passed quickly through my head. That owl must have read my mind. It left its perch, drove straight down that pole towards me like a guided missile or a torpedo headed for an enemy ship, with its wings tucked close up against its body for less wind resistance and more speed. It happened so fast, this brave white hunter was paralyzed with fear. When it got about 10 feet away from me, it folded out its wings, flipped from head first to feet first in a millisecond, like Batman. Those damn birds have talons, and it grabbed onto me everywhere. My shoulders, my ears, the hair of my head, and it beat the living daylights out of me. I'm serious. That white owl must have had a 5-foot wingspan. I swung my arms around in the air, trying to get the damn bird off me. I think I had my eyes closed half the time, just so they wouldn't get clawed out. Finally, I guess she beat me up to her satisfaction and let me go. Not because I won the battle, or she was scared of me, that much I'm sure of. I figure she flew away to check on her baby owls. I put the pistol back in my car immediately and headed for the nearest first aid kit. I never went near that flagpole again, owl or no owl, flag or no flag. I believe smart people refer to it as behavioral modification. The moral of this story? Don't ever think an owl is only wise and non-threatening. They are also very tough and extremely vicious. It's just another lesson I had to learn the hard way. You know, something they don't teach you in books. Ray Payton, Louisiana. That's a great story, Ray. I can't thank you enough for sharing it with us. Ray has also sent in a story for our upcoming military broadcast, and if you want to listen to the interview I had with him, go to the main website, search for Ray Payton, or episode number 201. Thank you, Ray.
Johnny, is this true?
Okay. I like to surf the internet looking for stories and other oddities. I do this in the name of the podcast, but the truth is, it's fun to see what's out there. What you're about to hear is what I call...
Johnny, is this true?
I will tell you a story and then ask the question. Did I make it up or is it true? Let's get started. On this edition of Johnny, Is This True? We have a tornado theme. Consider that a severe thunderstorm can generate wind gusts from 60 to 70 miles an hour and are capable of structural damage. It's not surprising wind gusts of 150 miles an hour or higher are capable of incredible and incredibly strange damage. We look at a few of these cases this time. Story 1. James Turney woke up on a Sunday morning. His first thoughts were to turn off the alarm that was driving him crazy. When he reached out for the offending clock, it wasn't there. In fact, the entire nightstand was missing. He rolled over on his back and slowly opened his eyes. As things came into focus, he quickly noted that the roof to his bedroom was also missing. Now, is this a real start to a real story, or was it all dreamed up by me? Well, if you said it was a dream, then you got it wrong. This reportedly happened in Pennsylvania during the May 31st, 1985 tornado outbreak. James was unharmed, but the nightstand was never found. Story 2. On April 27, 2011, in Smithville, Mississippi, a EF5 tornado carried a Ford Explorer roughly 1/2 mile. It then collided with the town's water tower, passing through it, still intact. The vehicle then traveled another 1/4 mile before coming to rest upright and drivable. Is this a tornado wonder? Or totally fake news? Well, this was not totally fake news. You see, the SUV took so much damage that it was barely recognizable as a pile of metal. How about that? Story 3. An EF3 tornado near Pampa, Texas, on November 16th, drove a corn stalk into a radiator of a truck in Armadillo, Texas. Now, this is totally not possible. Or is it? If you said possible, you got it right. According to a photo provided by Steve Kirch, chief meteorologist at KVII-TV, the cornstalk became covered in ice, turning it into a lethal radiator-killing weapon. Amazing. Story 4. Our last story is so strange that it has to be true. A woman who was hauling a trailer loaded with donkeys down to Florida pulled off the interstate into Ringgold, Georgia. She was looking for shelter at a Wendy's as a tornado swept through. Unfortunately, the wind slammed into the trailer and the doors flew off. Witnesses say they saw the back of the trailer fly off and then the donkeys fly out after it. No way, right? This didn't happen. This actually happened. Rhonda Bass, director of 911 communications for Catoosa County, reported this from her call logs. But the story doesn't stop there. 2 days later, a man who owns property across from the Wendy's, where the event occurred, called the 911 center to report that he had found 2 strange donkeys grazing on the hill. How about that? Do you have any strange but true stories you want to share? If you do, send them to ronsamazingstories@gmail.com, and I'll use them if I can.
It's time for another chapter of Anything You Can Do by Randall Garrett. The alien Nipe has been terrorizing Earth for 8 years. It has a nasty habit of appearing out of nowhere, slapping a person to death, and then eating all his flesh. In Chapter 5, we met Colonel Mannheim, who manages a young man named Bart Stanton, who he appears to be training to be some sort of Superman. We also found out they know where the Nipe's Nair lies and have known for 6 years and have done nothing about it. Next, Chapter 6 of Anything You Can Do by Randall Garrett. The Nipe prowled around the huge underground room, carefully checking his alarms. If anyone entered the network of tunnels at any point, the instruments would register that fact. They had to be adjusted, of course, for the presence of the small, omnivorous quadrupeds that ran through the tunnels in such numbers, but anything larger than they would be noted immediately. He did not like to leave this place. Here, over a period of 10 revolutions of this planet about its primary, he had built himself a nest that was almost comfortable. Here, too, were his workshops and his storehouses. He had reason to believe that he was safe here, screened and protected as he was, but each time he left or entered he ran the chance of being observed. Still, there was no help for it. Thus far, he had been hampered by technical problems. There were things he needed that he could not make for himself. Even his own vast memory, with its every bit of information instantly available, could only contain what had been acquired over a lifetime, and even his long life had not been long enough to acquire every bit of knowledge he needed. His work had been long and tedious. There were many things that could neither be made in his workshops nor obtained from the natives, things he did not know how to make and which the local species had not yet evolved in their own technology. Or, more likely, which had not been allowed them. In such cases, he had had to make do with other, lesser techniques, which added to the complexity of his job. But now another problem had intruded itself into his schedule. He had a name, Colonel Walther Mannheim. The meaning of the verbal symbolism was unknown to him. The patterns of the symbolism were even more evasive than the patterns of the language itself. Colonel seemed simple enough. It indicated a certain socio-military class that was rigidly defined in one way and very hazy in another. But the meanings and relationships of both Walther and Mannheim were beyond him. What difference, for instance, was there between a Walther and a William? Did a Mannheim outrank a Mandeville, or the other way around? What functions differentiated a John Smith from a Peter Taylor? He knew what a John was and what a Smith was. But John Smith was not, apparently, necessarily associated with sanitary plumbing. The meaning of some other names eluded him entirely. But that made little difference at the moment. The meaning of Colonel Walther Mannheim's symbolic nomenclature was secondary in comparison with his known function. That required that the Nipe must eventually find and confront Colonel Walther Mannheim. It meant time lost, of course. It meant that precious time, which should be given to building his communicator, must be given over to what was merely a protective action. But there was nothing to do but go on. It would never have occurred to the Nipe to give up, for to quit meant to die. And to die, here, now, was unthinkable. His alarms were all functioning, his defenses all set. He could now leave his hideaway knowing that if it were broken into while he was away, he would be warned in time. But he had no real fear of that. He had done everything he could do. And no intelligent creature, to the Nipe's way of thinking, would waste time worrying about a situation he could not improve upon. Taking with him the equipment he needed for the job he had to do, he entered the tunnel that ran southward from his base of operations. Once, as he moved along, one of the little quadrupeds approached him, its teeth bared. With an almost negligent flip of one powerful, super-fast hand, he slammed it against a nearby wall. It dropped and lay still. Another of its kind approached it cautiously. The Nipe noticed the approach with approval. The quadrupeds had no real intelligence, but they had the proper instincts. At last, the Nipe came to another of the many places where the tunnels met with others of the network. He crossed through several rooms, all very large and cluttered with the dusty, long-dead bones of hundreds of the local intelligent life-form. If, and he was not sure in his own mind of this, they could actually be called intelligent. But he moved carefully, stepping over the human bones and the empty, staring skulls. They had apparently been properly devoured, although he could not be sure whether it had been done by their own kind or by the little quadrupeds. Nonetheless, he would not willingly disturb their repose. He went on into the tunnel that led westward and followed it as it began to angle down. Finally, he came to the water's edge. To a human being, the cold expanse of water that gleamed like ink in the light of the Nipe's illuminator would have been a barricade as impenetrable as steel. But to the Nipe, the tidal pool was simply another of his defenses, for it concealed the only entrance he ever used. He went in after adjusting his scuba mask and began swimming toward the opening that led to the estuary of the sea, his eight strong limbs working in unison in a way that would have been the envy of a rowing team. At the jagged hole in the tunnel wall, the gap that led into open water, he paused to check his instruments. Only after he was certain that there were no sonar or other detector radiations did he propel himself onward, out into the estuary itself. An hour later, he was warily circling the spot where his little submarine was hidden. He pressed a button on a small device in his hand, and a signal was sent to the submarine. The various devices within it all responded properly. Nothing had been disturbed since the Nipe had set those devices weeks before. This was the touchiest part of any of his expeditions. There was always the chance, unlikely as it might be, that some one of the bipedal natives had found his machine. He dared not use it too close to his base because of the possibility of its dry vibrations being detected in the narrow estuary. Out here in the open sea, there was far less likelihood of that, but leaving a submarine concealed out here increased the danger he exposed himself to every time he left his hidden nest. Satisfied that the machine was just as he had left it, he entered it and started its engines. He moved slowly and cautiously until he was well out to sea, well away from the continental shelf and over the ocean deeps. Then, and only then, did he accelerate to full cruising speed. The full moon was in the west, hiding behind an array of low, scudding clouds, revealing its radiance in fitful bursts of silvery splendor that died again as another clotted cloud moved before the face of the white disk. The shifting light, shining through the breeze-tossed leaves of the palm trees on the beach below, made strange shadows on the sand, ever-changing patterns of gray and black on a background of white, moonlit sand. But the strangest shadow of all was one that did not change as the others did. A great, centipede-like shape that seemed to wash slowly ashore on the receding tide. For a short while it remained at the water's edge, apparently unmoving in the wash of the waves. Then, keeping low and balancing himself on his third pair of limbs, the Nipe moved in across the beach. The specially constructed sandals he wore left behind them a set of very human-looking footprints, prints that would remain unnoticed among the myriad of others that were already on the beach, left there by daytime bathers. It required more time yet to reach the city, and still more time to find the place he was looking for. It was almost dawn before he managed to find a storm sewer in which to hide for the day. It was partly his difficulty in finding a given spot in a city, almost any city, that had convinced the Nipe that the pseudo-intelligence of the bipeds of this planet could not really be called true intelligence. There was no standardized method of orienting oneself in a city. Not only were no two cities alike in their orientation systems, but the same city would often vary from section to section. Their coordinate systems meant almost nothing. Part of a given coordinate might be a number, and the rest of it a name, but the meanings of the numbers and names were never the same. It was as though some really intelligent outside agency had given them the basic idea of a coordinate system, and they, not having the intelligence to use it properly, had simply jumbled the whole thing up. That the natives themselves had no real understanding of any such system had long been apparent to him. The dwellers in any one area would naturally be familiar with it. They would know where each place was, regardless of what meaningless names and numbers might be attached to it. But strangers to that area would not know and could not know. The only thing they could possibly do would be to ask directions of a local citizen, which, the Nipe had learned, was exactly what they did. Unfortunately, it was not that simple for the Nipe. There was no way for him to walk up to a native and inquire for an address. He had to prowl unseen through the alleys and sewers of a city, picking up a name here, a number there, by eavesdropping on street conversations. He had found that every city contained certain uniformed individuals whose duty it was to direct strangers, and by focusing a directional microphone on such men and listening, it was possible to glean little bits of knowledge that could eventually be coordinated into a whole understanding of the city's layout. It was a time-consuming process, but it was the only way the job could be done. Reconnaissance took a tremendous amount of time away from his serious work, but that work could not proceed without materials to work with, and to get those materials required reconnaissance. The dilemma was unavoidable. And being what he was, the Nipe accepted the unavoidable and pursued his course with phlegmatic equanimity. Overhead, the city was beginning to waken. The volume of sound began to increase. Police Patrolman John Flanders relieved his fellow officer, Patrolman Fred Pilsudski, at a few minutes of 8 in the morning. It was a beautiful day, even for Miami. In the east, the morning sun shone brightly through the hard, transparent pressure glass that covered the street, making the smooth, resilient surface of the street itself glow with warm light. Overhead, Patrolman Flanders could see the air cars in their incessant motion, apparently random, unless one knew what the traffic pattern was and how to look for it. It was Patrolman Flanders' immediate ambition to be promoted to traffic patrol, so that he could be in an air car above the city instead of watching pedestrians down here on the streets.
"Morning, Fred," he said to his brother officer. "How'd the night go?"
"Hi, Johnny. Pretty good. Not much excitement."
He looked at his wristwatch.
"You're a couple minutes early yet."
"Yeah, the baby started singing for his breakfast at a god-awful hour. Harriet woke up to feed him, which woke me up, so here I am. If you want to give me the call button, I'll take over. You can go get yourself a cup of coffee."
"I'm up to here with coffee," Pilsudski said, indicating a point just below his left ear. "I'll have a beer instead."
He touched a switch at his belt and said,
"Area 37 HQ, this is 13392 Pilsudski."
A voice in his helmet phone said,
"37 HQ, go ahead, Pilsudski."
"Time 0758 hours. I'm being relieved by 14278 Flanders."
"Right, go ahead."
Pilsudski took off the light, strong helmet, reached inside it, opened a small sliding panel, and took out an object the size and shape of an aspirin tablet, the sealed unit that permitted him to understand the conversation over the police wave band. Without it, the police calls would have been gibberish. Flanders accepted the little gadget from the other officer and inserted it in his own helmet. Then he replaced the helmet on his head. "Area 37 HQ, this is 14278 Flanders. I am relieving 13392 Pilsudski." "37 HQ," said the voice in his ears. "Okay, Flanders, transfer recorded." Police Patrolman John Flanders, badge number 14278, was now officially on duty. He looked up into the sky. "Now, there's the place to be on a day like this, Fred. Traffic patrol." "Not me," said Pilsudski. "Too damn dull. I was on it for 6 months. Damn near drove me nuts. Nobody to talk to but another cop. Same cop, day after day. He was a nice guy, don't get me wrong. But Christ, nothing to do but watch for people breaking traffic pattern. Can't even pull over to the side and watch the traffic go by. It's dull, I'm telling you, Johnny. I asked for a transfer back to a beat so's I could see some people again." "Maybe," said Flanders. "I'd still like to try it." "Everybody to their own taste, I guess. Mitchell and Warber were in luck last night, though. Excitement." He sounded as though he meant the word to be sarcastic. "What happened?" Flanders asked. "Some boob was having a fight with his wife, and his air intake was goofing off at the same time. So while she's yelling at him, he puts his air car on hover." He pointed upward. "Right up there, in level two. He opens the window of his air car, mind you. His air intake ain't working, like I said. Mitchell, in car 87, spots him and heads for him, figuring there's trouble."
"But no trouble?" asked Flanders.
"Trouble enough. The driver's old lady throws a wrench at him, and it goes out the window."
He chuckled.
"First I heard about it, it was when that damn wrench comes down and bounces off the pressure glass, then up to the side of the building there and back to the pressure glass. Then it slides off into the rain gutter."
Flanders looked up at the curve of hard, tough, almost invisible pressure glass that covered the street.
"With all the cars overhead that we got in this city," Flanders said philosophically, "something like that's bound to happen ever so often. That's why that glass is up there, besides for keeping the rain off your head."
"Yeah," Pilsudski said.
"Anyway, Mitchell and Warber got there just as she tossed the wrench. Arrested both of 'em. Now, wasn't that exciting?"
Flanders grinned.
"Fred, if the rest of their tour of duty was as dull as you say it was, then I reckon that must have been real exciting."
"Ha," Pilsudski shrugged. "Well, I'm for that beer. See you tomorrow, Johnny."
"Right, take care of yourself."
As Pilsudski walked away, Flanders put his hands behind his back, grasping the left and the right. He spread his feet slightly apart. In that time-honored position of the foot patrolman, he surveyed his beat up and down both sides of the street. Everything looked perfectly normal. Another working day had begun. He had no idea that he was standing only a few yards from the most hated and feared killer on the face of the earth. The only clue that he could possibly have had to that killer's presence was a small ovoid the size and shape of a matchhead, a dark, dull gray in color, which protruded slightly from a sewer grating 6 feet away, supported on a hair-thin stalk. In one end was a tiny dark opening, and that opening was pointed directly at Officer Flanders' head. When he began walking slowly down the street, the little ovoid moved, turning slowly on its stalk to keep that dark hole pointed steadily. It was so small, that ovoid, and so inconspicuous, that no one, even looking directly at it, would have noticed it. The Knipe could see and hear without being either seen or heard himself. All morning long, the tiny ovoid remained in place, watching, listening. At 11:24, a woman in a cherry-pink dress walked up to Officer Flanders and said,
Pardon me, officer. Could you tell me where I could find the Donahue building?
And while the policeman told her, the Knipe listened carefully. Now he knew what street he was on and its location in respect to two other streets. He also had a number. He remembered them all, accurately and completely. It was a good beginning, he decided. It would not be too long before he would have enough to enable him to locate the address he was looking for. After that, there would only remain the job of observing and making plans to get what he wanted at that address. He settled himself to wait for more information. He knew that it would be a long wait. But he was prepared for that.
Second Interlude. The woman's eyes were filled with tears, for which the doctor was privately thankful. At least, he thought to himself, the original shock has worn off.
"And there's nothing we can do?" she asked. "Nothing?"
There was anguish in her voice.
"I'm afraid not," the doctor told her gently. "Not yet. There are research men working on the problem, and one day, perhaps—"
Then he shook his head.
"But not yet."
He paused.
"I'm sorry, Mrs. Stanton."
The woman sat there in the comfortable chair and looked at the specialist diploma on the doctor's wall, and yet she really didn't see the diploma at all. She was seeing something else, a kind of dream that had been shattered. After a moment she began to speak, her voice low and gentle, as though the dream were still going on, and she were half afraid she might waken herself if she spoke too loudly.
"Jim and I were so glad they were twins, identical twin boys. He said, I remember he said, we ought to call them Ike and Mike."
And he laughed a little when he said it, to show he didn't mean it. The doctor said nothing, waiting for her to go on.
"I remember I was propped up in the bed the afternoon after they were born, and Jim brought me a new bed jacket, and I said I didn't need a new one because I'd be going right home the very next day. And he said, 'Hell, kid, you don't think I'd buy a bed jacket just for hospital use now, do you? This is for breakfasts in bed, too.' And that's when he said he'd seen the boys and said we ought to name them Ike and Mike."
The tears were coming down Mrs. Stanton's cheeks heavily now, and the grief made her look older than her 24 years. But the doctor said nothing, letting her spill out her emotions in words.
"We'd talked about it before, you know, soon as the obstetrician found out that I was going to have twins. And Jim said that we shouldn't name them alike unless they were identical twins or mirror twins. If they were fraternal twins, we'd just name them as if they'd been ordinary brothers or sisters or whatever, you know?"
She looked at the doctor, her eyes pleading for understanding.
"I know," he said.
"And Jim was always kidding. If they were girls, he said, we ought to call them Flora and Dora, or Annie and Fanny, or maybe Susie and Floozy. He was always kidding about it, you know?"
"I know," said the doctor.
And then when they were identical boys, he was very sensible about it. He was always so sensible. 'We'll call them Martin and Bartholomew,' he said. 'Then, if they want to call themselves Mart and Bart, they can, but they won't be stuck with any rhyming names if they don't want them.' Jim was always very thoughtful that way, doctor. Very thoughtful."
She seemed suddenly to realize that she was crying, and took a handkerchief out of her sleeve to dab at her eyes and face.
"I'll have to quit crying," she said, trying to sound very brave and very strong. "After all, it could have been worse, couldn't it? I mean, the radiation could have killed my boy, too. Jim's dead, yes, and I've got to get used to that. But I still have two boys to take care of, and they'll need me." "Yes, Mrs. Stanton, they will," said the doctor. "They'll both need you very much, and you'll have to be very gentle and very careful with both of them."
How do you mean that?" she asked.
The doctor settled back in his chair and chose his words carefully. "Identical twins tend to identify with each other, Mrs. Stanton. There is a great deal of empathy between people who are not only of the same age, but genetically identical. If they were both completely healthy, there would normally be very little trouble in their education at home or in school. Any of the standard texts on psychodynamics in education will show you the pitfalls to avoid when dealing with identical siblings. But your sons are no longer identical, Mrs. Stanton. One is normal, healthy, and lively. The other is, well, as you know, he is slow, sluggish, and badly coordinated. The condition may improve with time, but until we know more about such damage than we do now, he will remain an invalid." He had been watching her for further signs of emotional upset, but she seemed to be listening calmly enough. He went on. "That's the trouble with radiation damage, Mrs. Stanton. Even when we can save the victim's life, we cannot always save his health. We can see, I think, what sort of psychic disturbances this might bring about in such a pair. The ill boy tends to identify with the well one, and, oddly enough, the reverse is also true. If they are not properly handled during their formative years, Mrs. Stanton, both can be badly damaged emotionally."
I think I understand, Doctor," the young woman said. "But what sort of thing should I look out for? What sort of things should I avoid?"
"First off, I suggest you get a good man in psychic development," the doctor said. "I myself would hesitate to prescribe. It's out of my field. But I can say that, in general, most of your trouble will be caused by a tendency for the pair to swing into one of two extremes. At one extreme, you'll have mutual antagonism. This arises when the ill child becomes jealous of the other's health, while, on the other hand, the healthy one becomes jealous of the extra consideration that is shown to his crippled brother. At the other extreme, the healthy boy may identify so closely with his brother that he feels every slight or hurt, real or imagined, which the ill boy is subjected to. He becomes extremely over-solicitous, over-protective. At the same time, the invalid brother may come to depend completely on his healthy twin. In both these situations, there is a positive feedback that constantly worsens the condition. It requires a great deal of careful observation and careful application of the proper educational stimuli to keep the situation from developing toward either extreme. You'll need expert help if you want both boys to display the full abilities of which they are potentially capable."
"I see," the woman said. "Could you give me the name of a good man, doctor?"
The doctor nodded and picked up a book on his desk.
"I'll give you the names of several. You can pick the one you like best, the one with whom you seem to be the most comfortable. Try several or all of them before you decide. They're all good men. There are many good women in the field, too. But in this case, I think a man would be best. Of course, if one of them thinks a woman is indicated, that's up to him. As I said, that isn't my field."
He opened the small book and riffled through it to find the names he wanted.
"What the heck is the Knipe building? And why aren't the authorities trying to stop him?" To find out, come back next week for another chapter of Anything You Can Do by Randall Garrett.
That was Mark Nelson, and thank you for reading for us. Mark is a professional audiobook narrator and producer. He has donated his skills to the podcast, and I, for one, am enjoying his work.
He has narrated more than 70 professional audiobooks. His works include crime fiction, science fiction, horror, nonfiction, histories, and of course the classics. Mark also donates his time at LibriVox.org and has completed over 100 projects for them. How about that? And thank you, Mark.
As read by Amazing Stories, read by Amazing People.
This time on As Read By, we continue with the Growing Up series of stories from Tom Williams. This time, Tom tells us all about cause and effect. He has titled this A Weekend of Disaster, and the floor is all yours, Tom.
Growing Up, A Weekend of Disaster. As I believe I've mentioned before, my most fond memories were going into town on the weekends and staying at one of my two aunts' apartments, hanging out with my cousins, going to the movies, and if it was too hot or no other mischief in mind, just sitting on the shaded balcony and just talking about what happened in the past week when we were apart from each other. This weekend of disaster started out, as most weekends did. After all the joking and horsing around finally ended, then we decided, well, my cousin Fred had a grand idea. Let's go downstairs and in the back of the house, and we can climb up the drain pipe to the second floor and into the kitchen window at the empty apartment where Mom moved out of. Wow, that was an ingenious idea. Now, this wasn't an idea for girls. Only boys can do things like that. So my cousin Barb went back to her mom's apartment on the second floor as we began our challenge. About the same age, Fred of a small stature, he was feisty, and I always admired him. He was fearless. My other cousin, as they called it those days, was big-boned. I don't mean fat. He just had a larger frame as we did. Sometimes he would pick on me, and since I wasn't the one to fight, little Fred would be all over him, and that would settle that. You leave Tommy alone, I've heard so many times as a kid. Now back to that drain pipe. First, Fred was to climb the pipe to the kitchen window. He scurried up that pipe and disappeared like a monkey. Then went Kermit, and he, too, made it with almost no problem. Being that he was heavier of the three of us, I believe he caused some damage to the drain pipe's anchor on the wall. Because as I almost got to the kitchen window, my world turned into slow motion. The anchor gave away, and me and the pipe broke loose from the wall, and as the pipe bent, it lowered me slowly to the ground. I couldn't believe my luck. I was still alive, nothing broken. Realizing that we were in major trouble, though, we all scrambled in all directions like a bunch of rabbits. To this day, I don't remember seeing either of my two cousins the rest of the weekend. Vanished in thin air. I hope I would see them next weekend. Now, if only that was all. I ran upstairs to my other aunt's apartment where my cousin Barb was. After catching my breath and calming down, Barb and I went out in the long hallway that connected all apartment entrances. We started kicking a basketball around, back and forth to each other, bouncing it off the wall. That is, until I managed to destroy the ceiling light cover. Back to my aunt's apartment to get a broom and clean up the glass and pray that no one would notice that bare light bulb hanging from the ceiling. Then we heard someone coming up the stairs, fast, into Barb's apartment. I'm afraid it was a little too fast, for as we pushed the front door to the apartment open, the doorknob knocked a hole in the drywall. Oh, man, were we in for it now? We're in some deep trouble. Then Barb thought that she could minimize the death sentence by simply cleaning the apartment for her mom. So clean that her mom wouldn't notice all the damages that we had done. That would do it, I'm sure. The place never looked so good until the final blow. Removing the thin glass top from the coffee table and cleaning it spotlessly, she placed it on the sofa in order to clean the table itself. My, but things were looking so good. She wiped the sweat from her forehead and sat, or more like plump, down on the sofa, shattering the coffee table top, which she forgot was still there. I know this was a long-winded story, and I do have the capacity to remember details. But from that point on, due to the shock, I still, to this day, have a blackout. Sincerely, Tom.
Thank you, Tom. Your story brought to mind a bit of my dark side. When I was a kid, I would get into trouble. Once I remember going to the park to play with my friends. We thought, what a wonderful idea it would be to take an old rusted barrel, get inside it, and roll each other down the hill. Well, it was a lot of fun until it wasn't, and Danny got hurt. To make matters worse, we played so long that all of us missed dinner. When I finally did get home, I was informed by my dad that a spanking was coming my way, but first, I would have to eat my cold dinner. I don't have to tell you that that was the longest meal of my life, and to this day, all I can remember is the waiting. Wait, I do remember never being late again, but I did continue to get into trouble from time to time. For those of you who don't know, Tom lives in Germany, was raised in the South, and sends in these stories from his youth. I hope you all are enjoying them as much as I do. Thanks again, Tom. Podcast for this time. I want to thank our contributors, Wendy Hogan, Ray Payton, Mark Nelson, and Tom Williams for taking part in the show. Also, I was informed that last week I forgot to thank Mercy B for taking part. So, thank you, Mercy B. Sorry about that. If you want to follow the podcast or the blog, it's easy to do. Just head to ronsamazingstories.com. And there you'll find every possible link you'll need. Wherever you listen to us, please leave some feedback about the show. It really does help us to grow. Thank you for listening, and I hope you come again to find out what are Ron's Amazing Stories.
All of the vintage audio used in the podcast is believed to be in the public domain. Ron's Amazing Stories does not own the rights to any of the old-time radio used here. If you hold the rights to any of the shows played, please contact us immediately at ronsamazingstories.com.